to bathe, because we don't want them to find out the bad and the sad news by rumors.
Hamas is saying it's going to release a total of some 50 Israeli hostages over the next 4 days.
Brian Mann, you're in the West. What are you hearing about the Palestinians due to be released?
Yeah, we're expecting roughly 39 Palestinians to be free. And this process is happening more slowly. We're now hearing it could be another 4 hours before people start to come across. Israel says they're all going to be young, or throwing stones or Molotov cocktails or other actions that Israel views as supporting terrorism. No high-level militia leaders involved here. And I should say right now, a crowd of hundreds of mostly young men has gathered at the checkpoint where this transfer is expected to take place. And there's already...
How are Palestinians in the West Bank reacting to the people that are going to be released?
You know, there's so much anger and resentment here that's built up over decades of Israel's occupation, heightened by the fighting in Gaza. I was at a protest following the Friday prayers here. Hamas, they say Hamas's attack October 7th wasn't the start of all this violence, but was part of a longer, painful history. There's also fear that once this four-day truce ends, things could get even more ugly in Gaza. I spoke with Raj Hadeh, who teaches physics at a school here in Ramallah.
I feel... good for the people to have a rest from the bombardment, but this is not the solution. This massacre has to be stopped, not to give the people 4 days of rest. It's a massacre. They are slaughtering children, and this has to be stopped.
Next week.
Daniel, quickly, any hope that this pause could become permanent?
Well, we've heard the Israeli prime minister say that the war will continue after these 4 days pause, although there are a few more days they're giving Hamas to release more hostages. We've now heard Egypt saying that that 12 Thai hostages from Thailand will be released by Hamas. And, you know, Israelis here in Israel feel that this is a moment of hope for after 7 weeks of just brutal waiting for good news.
That's Daniel S. Across the country, many progressive prosecutors have been labeled soft on crime for criminal justice reforms, such as eliminating cash bail and not prosecuting. So, Sasha, tell us about this man.
So this is a St. Louis homicide detective named Ron. So far, he's declined to take the stand in at least 9 cases. And Murphy thinks his absence hurt prosecutors' chances of getting convictions. And A, there's another trial coming up soon, and Murphy won't testify in that one either.
Wow. Why won't he testify?
Because the St. Louis prosecutor's office put Murphy on a list of cops with credibility problems. Murphy landed on it, he believes unfairly, because of some Facebook posts interpreted as being racist. But even though Murphy was on that list, the prosecutor's office still asked him to testify in cases. Murphy says it's hypocritical to question his integrity, yet trust him to take the stand. And he says if he does testify, defense lawyers might attack him about why he's on the list. So he's not doing it.
All right, so now I'm going to guess that there is a progressive prosecutor at the center of the story.
Yes, there is. It's a woman named Kim Gardner. She was the top prosecutor in St. Louis for nearly 7 years. She vowed to reduce mass incarceration, hold police accountable, but she clashed with police. They say she failed to prosecute legitimate cases, and Detective Murphy strongly opposes her policies.
But we didn't break the system. We kept arresting people, and she kept letting them out, you know. Refusing cases, refusing good cases.
And A, Gardner resigned this spring after huge pushback and a lot of dysfunction in her office. And Murphy is now retired, but he's still refusing to testify in ongoing cases.
Now, as we mentioned earlier, I mean, many progressive prosecutors around the country have also faced opposition recently.
Right. Philadelphia, Baltimore, San Francisco, Boston, I think L.A., where you are.
Yeah.
They all have or had progressive prosecutors who were hit with huge resistance, and some were forced out.
A detective deliberately tanking a case. That is horrifying to hear, quite honestly. But I have been faced with, Kim Gardner has been faced with, and others have been faced with, an unprecedented level of hate and vitriol from those who were previously partners with others who did this work.
Kim Fox is referring there to police departments and police unions, which she says were rooting for her to fail from the get-go.
Before I put my hand on the Bible to take the oath to take this job, there was a widely known police blog going around naming me Crimesha, C-R-I-M-E-S-H-A. which is a play on the word crime and what I believe to be a racist insinuation about me being black with the name Isha, spelling my name with three X's to insinuate the sexualization of who I am, putting out my address and saying perhaps if people came to my house and assaulted my daughters, then my view on crime would be different.
So she thinks police weren't going to accept her no matter how much she tried to work with them.
All right, now, police departments and police unions, what are their main complaints about progressive prosecutors?
Basically, they view them as enemies of old-fashioned law enforcement. Many police say they're too liberal and they're making cities less safe. I want to play you some computer named Sarah George.
Unfortunately, this is kind of the product of Sarah George's super progressive soft-on-crime approach where we arrest the same people daily and they get out the same day.
He went on to encourage them to vote for her opponent in an upcoming election. So some progressive prosecutors feel that some police are actively undermining them in the community.
Sasha, what do we know about crime rates in places that have progressive prosecutors?
COVID versus the economy versus progressive policies. Now, some police believe criminals are emboldened by progressive prosecutors because they think there will be no consequences for illegal behavior. President of the St. Louis NAACP, a man named Adolphus Pruitt.
A lot of folks who are committing crimes today are not saying, hey, we got this liberal prosecutor in office. Let's run out here and commit some crimes. It is not happening that way. You have people who are not afraid to go to jail. It's as simple as that. They're at a point in their lives where, hell, my life ain't worth crap anyway, some of them feel. And then you trying to tell me that jail is worse? A lot of them don't feel that way.
So both prosecutors and police have that to contend with, too.
All right, that's NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer. Sasha, thanks for bringing this to us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Peter Bryant in for Alex Crow. Coming up on Morning Edition, today is Native American Heritage Day, but Indigenous history is taught year-round in Wisconsin schools. In today's Wisconsin Life.
A sustaining membership is a great way to support the WPR programs you love. WPR.org. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from the Medical Oxygen Hyperbaric Clinic Madison, providing treatment for cancer radiation injuries, non-healing wounds, and burns. Insurance accepted. More at medical-pediatricians
who answer listener questions and offer some advice on how to travel with young children. Colder today, that's the forecast. Sunny and windy, two highs in the mid-20s to mid-30s. Windy and dry again tomorrow, and then some snow showers statewide by Sunday, especially in the morning, with some accumulation possible, highs in the 20s.
Using real-time data to uncover insights, stay decision-ready, and prepare for whatever's next. The finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, and supporting land conservation to a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at storyworth.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Adam, Jack, and Ryan Mett are the brothers behind the pop band AJR. Their father died as they were finalizing their fifth studio.
At 35. Now I don't know if there's anything else.
My colleague Steve Inskey spoke with the group about the pensive mood of this album as the brothers plan a 43-city tour across North America starting April 2nd in Norfolk, Virginia.
I've heard a lot of your music voluntarily because I like it. I've heard a lot of music involuntarily because it is on the hot music radio station that my kids listen to. So
Oh, cool. It's
got a broad audience, I think. And in thinking about what you do, I ended up thinking about a sentence. You tell me if I've got it right or got it wrong. You have been producing joyous, expansive, celebratory music about people who feel really bad about themselves.
Wow. This is Ryan. I think that describes it well. Yeah, I think we are not depressing people, but we're also kind of realistic people. We know how screwed up life can be sometimes. And I think we always try to find a balance of, okay, if we're going to talk about something really deep, let's add a little juxtaposition in there. Let's have a more upbeat, clap thing or a weird production quirky element, just to remind people that, you know, life is sometimes okay.
You've got a song here called Yes, I'm a Mess. Yes, I'm a mess with an S on my chest, got stress filling up my head. Yes.
This is Jack, and that song is about when things get awfully stressful and difficult in life. I feel like everyone kind of has this brief fantasy of, what if I was able to kind of start over? What if I was able to throw away my life, move to a new city, change my name, and basically take it all from the top? Way to like show, you know, I'm truly a mess underneath, but I'm kind of making it look like I'm this hero on top. So that's kind of how we started off the course, and that's kind of the entire feel of the album.
I can't help but note this album seems to have been composed in a time of loss for you, a time of tragedy. What was happening?
Right as we were starting to write the album, our father got really sick.
I gotta leave for Paris now. My band goes on at 10. And my dad can't get out of bed.
Then it turns out that there was an issue with his lung, which turned into cancer. And basically the entire time we were writing the album, it got so bad so quickly that it became a lot more personal and emotional than we had planned on. And it was this sort of tough thing which made us kind of grow like 30 years in the span of 8 months, which was sort of needing to write this album. We had a due date for it and needing to put everything we had into it, but at the same time being there for our father and having to rush back. We kind of inadvertently wrote our most personal and most emotional album.
God is really real when you really, really need him. Karma just appears when you suddenly believe it.
The song God is Really Real includes that line, my dad can't get out of bed. That's a devastating line to hear.
It was made through massive amount of tears and anxiety and fear, an amount that we never felt again, honestly. Even when he passed, it was the saddest thing any of us have ever had to go through. But that fear in the moment of what's going to happen, imagining the worst, that never came up again.
I'm listening to you put names to your different emotions, which is impressive because in the song itself, describing that moment, you write, we can't face our feelings, so we're making lots of jokes, which is absolutely what I would have been doing.
Yeah, that's something that you don't really know until you go through a grief in your family. This is Ryan, is that there's like a weird fun element to it. It's like all the barriers that made your dad, and we can't talk about this thing because it's too emotional or whatever, that goes away. You're like taking care of him. Like that was the year. It was like really sad, but it was also really funny. And we got to see a side of him that we never saw before.
Is there?
We were kind of worried that fans weren't going to like this one as much. And we put it out. And a lot of fans are telling us this is their favorite album that we've ever made. So to answer your question, that worries me a little bit. I hope that we never have and fans will connect to it.
So you're getting ready for the stadiums and everything else.
It's crazy. Yeah, this has been like the number one goal of this band is to play arenas. Like we started off straight.
Did you literally, when you were like on street corners, say to yourselves, someday we'll be doing this in an arena?
This is Adam. The process of growing as a band is something that I think that we all fell in love with because we didn't skip any step, every single step along the way. And the same thing goes for the music. We've had a bunch of songs that have gotten popular in different ways, and that keeps opening us up to different audiences.
It's influencing the music you're writing, is what you're saying. You're growing as musicians because of the way you've had to grow.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, Adam, Jack, and Ryan, thanks very much for taking the time. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
There are a lot of suitcases for airlines to keep track of, and if one goes missing for long enough, everything in it ends up at a huge store in Alabama.
Even a fraction of a percent of all lost items is going to accumulate quickly.
That and catch up on the latest news, including Wisconsin news with Brady Carlson. All things considered from 4 until 6:30 today on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Up next, NPR headlines followed by WPR News. It's now 8:30.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A group of 13 hostages held by Hamas is scheduled to be released this hour as part of an agreement with Israel. The women and children to be set free are among 50 hostages to be released by Hamas as part of a deal that calls for a four-day pause in the fighting. In exchange, Israel has agreed to release 150 Palestinians from Israeli jails during that pause in fighting, which began hours ago. Sarit Sarfati is with Israel's welfare ministry. She says social workers will be on hand at the UN's Arab Emirates. That's where countries will discuss their commitments to lowering greenhouse gas emissions. Guterres describes the accelerating pace of melting ice in Antarctica as absolutely devastating. He says countries will need to take action at the upcoming climate talks in Dubai. This is NPR News.
With Wisconsin Public Radio News, I'm Peter Bryant. Young people's use of libraries would be under increased scrutiny under a Republican bill being considered in the state legislature. As Anya Van Wagendonk reports, it comes amid nationwide restrictions on what students read and learn.
Under the bill, librarians would be required to alert parents about what their kids are borrowing. Republican Representative Barbara Dietrich of Oconomowoc says she's looking for a compromise at a time when some parents are pushing for book bans. But Casey Meehan of the free expression group PEN America says this bill will intimidate librarians from offering certain types of books.
When we look at the books that are being targeted and ultimately removed from classrooms, you know, we see overwhelmingly these books include LGBTQ plus representation or include characters of color or talk about race and racism.
The Wisconsin Library Association says it's still
students and their advisors to sue over alleged free speech violations. At a public hearing, Joe Cohn of the National Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression said 17 states like California and West Virginia have passed similar legislation.
What you'll notice is that they are not all red states, they are not all blue states, they are not all purple states. They fall into all of those categories, and almost all of these bills pass with unanimous support.
The Wisconsin bill is based on model legislation from the Student Press Law Center in Washington, D.C. Colder weather's in the forecast for today and right through the weekend with sunshine today, high temperatures in the mid-20s to mid-30s. It'll be windy, too. Dry, windy, and chilly again tomorrow with some snow showers developing by tomorrow night. And then on Sunday, snow showers spreading across the state, especially in the morning. Continued windy, highs in the 20s and...
Films presenting Napoleon, directed by Ridley Scott and starring Joaquin Phoenix... Napoleon tells the story of Napoleon Bonaparte's rise to power, now playing exclusively in theaters. And from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. The day after Thanksgiving was officially named Native American Heritage Day in 2008 to honor and remember the culture and contributions of the indigenous people of America. American Studies at Yale and a member of the Timok tribe of the Western Shoshone Indians of Nevada. My co-host Steve Inskeep spoke with him about the opportunities of Native American Heritage Day and where such recognitions fall short.
It's an evolving institutionalized commitment made by many entities, government and non. And it also follows what many Native Americans feel to be a national day of mourning around the Thanksgiving holiday, which is not universally shared, but is often particularly animates Northeastern indigenous nations who feel their communities and histories have never been fully recognized or incorporated.
I think we understand why some people would see this as a day of mourning, because it's a moment to mark a loss of sovereignty, a loss of land, and any number of other tragedies and brutalities over the centuries. But you have delved into that same history, and while acknowledging the awfulness of it, you seem to take a different angle or make a different argument about the roles of Native
recent movements towards self-determination that make our contemporary era one worth recognizing in a different register.
We're coming up on the 100th anniversary of an event that can be described as an effort to fully integrate Indians into the body politic, the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924. What was it and how significant was it?
The Indian Citizenship Act of 1924 is part of a larger effort of early 20th century Native American activists and allies to put forward a final kind of recognition of indigenous peoples as citizens of the United States. It's less kind of celebrated than other what we might think of as civil rights achievements in American history, in part because citizenry is not always the kind of primary form of indigenous advocacy or the outcome that many indigenous activists have aspired to. Many at the time were actually a little ambivalent about it because it was so rooted in a larger discourse of property ownership and assimilative practices of Christianity, Christian adoption, English language usage, and a kind of distancing away from tribal communities themselves. And this, as you know, had been part of the federal government's civilization program since the 1870s, removing children from boarding schools, alienating reservation land. So it's not something that is as kind of celebratory as other subjects.
Would you say that Native nations are, on the whole, gaining a larger role in American society in the last few generations?
I would say that the last few generations have witnessed an incredible rise in the sovereign authority of Native nations in ways that we haven't seen in contemporary American history. It's difficult celebrating these subjects in a kind of simplified way, but if we can understand the rising tide of indigenous sovereignty that has made Native nations self-governing, economically viable, even like attractive as tourist destinations, we can envision a kind of more inclusive and heterogeneous vision of America in which race relations are not mired in a kind of myopic black-white binary.
I think you're also telling me that I should think of Native Americans not solely as victims when I think about their role in history, but as people with agency who fought back and who added something to the culture here.
Correct. And being a member of a Native American nation is a form of citizenry that many Americans have a hard time understanding. I am, and many Native peoples are, members of both their tribal communities and the federal or national community. And that distinctiveness is something we should not be scared of, but should embrace and try to learn and celebrate, particularly on Native American Heritage Day.
That was my colleague Steve Inske speaking with Ned Blackhawk, a professor of history and American studies at Yale. Today is Black Friday, and many Americans are out looking for a good deal. As always, it's wise to keep an eye out for scams, but are companies doing enough to protect you from being tricked? Here's NPR's Jenna McLaughlin.
Cybercriminals love the holiday season. The internet is flooded with ads clamoring for shoppers' attention, and that makes it easier to slip in a scam. At this point, you probably know to watch out for phishing emails. But it might surprise you to know that there's a tool that's been around a long time that could help solve this problem. It's called DMARC, or the Domain Message Authentication Reporting and Conformance Protocol. Whew. It's actually pretty simple. It basically helps prove the sender is who they say they are.
DMARC seeks to bring trust and confidence to the visible from address of an email so that when you receive an email from an address at wellsfargo.com or bestbuy.com, you can say with absolute certainty it definitely came from them.
Robert Holmes is with the cybersecurity firm Proofpoint. According to his new research, more than half of the top 50 online retailers in the United States, they're not fully compliant with DMARC. Experts are predicting record-breaking holiday shopping this year. That makes for a lot of potential for fraud. Holmes helps explain why with a timely analogy.
The way to look at this is Gmail on Black Friday, it's like kind of JFK Airport over Thanksgiving. So imagine you're at JFK Airport on one of these days with lots of people coming and going, and imagine a world where that airport didn't check IDs. Lots of nefarious activity would happen.
But there's good news. Early next year, Google and Yahoo will be requiring companies to use DMARC authentication. Otherwise, their messages will be more likely to get flagged as spam or blocked entirely. Holmes suggests it's important that companies take on a big part of the burden of securing their customers, rather than train everyone to be cybersecurity experts just to buy Christmas gifts.
So the thing about good security, it should be invisible to Joe Public.
Even so, that might not be the end of consumer problems.
I think the consequences of getting this wrong are severe. Legitimate email gets blocked.
That's because big companies have a big supply chain. They give third parties permission to send emails on their behalf. You know those automated messages you get when your flight time changes or a payment is due? Those services need to be secured too, or they might get blocked. If retailers don't take those kinds of things into consideration, you might miss a scam, but you could also miss a flight. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Morning Edition. Thanks for joining us this Friday. As we heard a few minutes ago, today is Native American Heritage Day, but Indigenous history is taught year-round in Wisconsin schools. Just ahead, today's Wisconsin Life, we hear from a WPR listener who wanted to know nutritionists who answer listener questions and offer some advice on how best to travel with young children.
On the next Fresh Air, we feature the interview our co-host Tanya Mosley recorded with Leslie Jones last September after the publication of Jones's memoir. The interview is filled with stories about what Jones' life was like before she turned 47 and became the oldest person ever to join the cast of Saturday Night Live. Join us.
You can hear Fresh Air tonight starting at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Restaurants who need community support more than ever, both in-store and online.
Support for WGTD comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Benefit specialists help navigate Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other benefit programs. Their services are free and confidential. Call 262-605-6646 for more info.
It's 16 minutes before 9 o'clock. And here's some of what's happening in the nearly 7-week conflict. In state news, public and school libraries would have to notify parents about what their kids are borrowing under a Republican bill in the Wisconsin state legislature. And student newspapers would be protected from interference by high school or college administrators under a bipartisan bill before state lawmakers in Wisconsin. You can find more Wisconsin News at WPR.org and start your day with WPR's daily podcast, Wisconsin Today. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Data IQ, a platform for everyday AI, Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. This is NPR.
And it's time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a listener question about education.
Wisconsin is one of 12 states that requires Native American content to be taught in schools. That prompted Maria Novotny to reach out to WPR's Wisconsin Project, asking us how educators are teaching this in the classroom. As WPR's Gabby Vinnick reports, schools are working to integrate Indigenous histories, cultures, and tribal sovereignty into the curriculum.
In a Madison West High School classroom, students take their seats in their first period class. This morning, they're talking about news involving the Cherokee Nation and the push to have First Nation representation in Congress. One by one, students like senior Abby O'Callahan
share to kind of make sure that there's a real change in policy.
The class is just one example of how students are connecting the histories of Wisconsin's First Nations to the present day. And it wasn't too long ago that legislation known as Act 31 spurred this education. Since 1991, the law has mandated that public schools and public and private universities teach the histories, cultures, and tribal sovereignty of tribal nations in Wisconsin. It was in response to the violence that erupted in northern Wisconsin in the 1980s. Members of the Ojibwe tribe were spearfishing, and protesters blocked them from exercising a treaty right they reserved. J.P. Leary is of Cherokee descent. He's an associate professor of First Nations Studies at UW-Green Bay. He wrote a book about Act 31.
The real policy problem
that Act 31 is addressing is the lack of meaningful opportunities to learn accurate, authentic information about the federally recognized tribes and bands in Wisconsin.
David O'Connor agrees. He's a consultant at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. O'Connor is a member of the Ojibwe tribe and offers educators resources about Wisconsin's First Nations on topics like treaty rights, indigenous languages, and festivities. He encourages educators to weave those lessons into subjects beyond social studies.
If you teach it from a tribal sovereignty lens first, you could teach Native histories and cultures 10 times easier.
Wisconsin is home to 11 federally recognized tribal nations. Teachers like Jeff Ryan of Prescott High School have been working to integrate Native histories more deeply into their lessons. Since 2000, it's
to gain a full understanding of the experience, whether it be the history or the contemporary issues connected to Native people, you have to access and talk with Native people.
There are more than 500 tribal nations in the U.S. Ryan and his students discuss what that means.
500 ways of thinking, 500 ways of talking, 500 ways of living, 500 ways of being.
Some critics say Act 31 has no teeth. The law requires the subject matter to be taught at least 3 times in grades K through 12. But since Wisconsin is a local control state, it's up to school boards and administrators to implement curriculum. Since its passage, more resources have become available for teachers to use. Even so, O'Connor says that for some educators, it's their first time learning the content. Sometimes it contradicts what they were taught.
Nick brought us that story on First Nations education in Wisconsin's classrooms. And the story idea came from an audience question. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
262-636-9285 or visit RacineSymphony.org.
Visit WPR.org.
Temporary ceasefire in Gaza. That's in the newscast at 9 o'clock. Classical music starts after that with Morning Classics. In sports, the Packers beat the Detroit Lions 29-22 yesterday, and the Badgers football team takes on Minnesota to wrap up the regular season this Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Trains, planes, automobiles. According to AAA, more than 55 million Americans are expected to be on the move at some point during this holiday season. And let's face it, holiday travel is stressful. The cost, the crowds, the weather delays. And then you add kids into the mix. If you've ever done it, then you know it can amp up the stress factor exponentially. So we thought we would try to help by answering your questions about traveling with kids. And for this, we've called two pediatricians who are also parents who have been through it themselves. Dr. Candace Jones is a pediatrician from Orlando, Florida. Welcome.
Thanks for having me this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. And Dr. Jamie Friedman is a pediatrician from San Diego, California. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much, and good morning.
Good morning. So I'm going to start with you, Dr. Friedman. Do you have any worries when you travel with your kids? And if so, what are they? Or maybe what's the biggest one?
Well, my kids are grown, interested, entertained, so we don't experience the meltdowns that I think everybody dreads when they travel with their children.
Dr. Jones, what about you? What is your biggest worry when you travel with your children?
We're right in the thick of everything you mentioned in your introduction. I have a 15-year-old, so I understand the pressure that parents are under because I will be right with them.
So let's hear some questions from listeners. And this is from Erica Voch, and she's in Sacramento, California.
What's the real risk of kids contracting COVID on a flight? We haven't traveled since before the pandemic began and would love to, but we're concerned with the risk of COVID since our kids are still so young. They're only 2 years old and 5 months old. The 2-year-old is vaccinated. The 5-month-old is still too young to be vaccinated.
Dr. Friedman, thoughts?
Well, I think it's a really good question, and I'm glad she brought up the idea of vaccinating because for kids who can't wear a mask, that's really your number one way to reduce the risk of getting COVID. The problem with air travel is when you're in the air, it's good. There's a lot of air turnover, which can really help keep particles out of the air. But it's those times when you're sitting there during boarding and then also deplaning when you arrive at the airport. I think the best thing to do is do your research on what are the rates where you are, where you're going, bring some hand sanitizer with you. And if the two-year-old can wear a mask, you know, you can actually try that as well.
Dr. Jones, anything you want to add?
I totally agree with that. I think anywhere you can create some space for yourself in lines at the airport and take advantage of that family boarding so you have a little more space and you're not all crowded up, creating those barriers are very effective, and masking, absolutely.
All right, Dr. Jones, let's go to you first on this one. This one is from Amy Leo, who is in Tacoma Park, Maryland.
How can I ensure in the midst of disrupted routines and new environments that we all get the best sleep possible while traveling?
And you can hear that Amy is in the thick of it. You can hear that baby in the background. She knows what she's talking about. What do you say, Dr. Jones?
We all have been there as parents. I think this is where we try to manage our expectations when you're traveling, especially if it's international or a different time zone, and give yourself some grace and try to have a little patience for your kids because they will get off. And as soon as possible, when you get to where you're going, just kind of reestablishing your bedtime or having those things that make them feel comfortable, their lovies, their passies, their favorite treats, anything that can recreate what they're used to is usually very helpful for getting them back on track.
But what I think I hear you saying is don't fly across the country or to Europe or, you know, around the world for a wedding and then expect to go to that wedding the next day and have everybody be happy.
That's correct. Pre-planning is the key, and travel maybe a couple of days before so that you can get acclimated. I know we do that when we travel.
We also got a lot of questions about how to eat on the road with kids. Are there some snacks or meals or something that people could bring along for their kids to help them? And or is there anything parents should not pack? Dr. Jones, you have thoughts about this?
You know, I often recommend to parents, this is the time where to keep the peace, where maybe some of all of our pediatrician healthy rules can be, you know, put on pause. But things like if you want to try to go healthy, healthy, non-perishable foods like packaged bars, nut butters and crackers, making a trail mix, even some fresh fruit or dried fruits are.
Because I think this is something that is important for people to hear, even if they have kids who have an issue or disability or they don't. And I'll just play that and then we'll talk about it.
My name is Kimberly Todd and I'm from Sacramento, California. We travel often internationally as a family with our autistic daughter. Traveling with her as a young child was very stressful. Can you share information on how to obtain accommodations for a flight or what airport services may be available to traveling families that need additional support?
Dr. Friedman, do you want to start? What are your thoughts about this?
I think it does make sense to call ahead and say, hey, or at least call the airline and say, hey, can we get pre-boarding? So if you can get pre-boarding and be out of the crowd and on the plane and get settled, that can be helpful. I do think it's really important, you know, as the sort of the theme of this whole session is having sameness and familiarity. So whatever your child with special needs is used to, if there is, you know, something, you know, manipulatives in their hands that they like to have, things that they, if they're very oral, things that they can put in their mouth, if they're bothered by noise and they will wear, you know, noise canceling headphones, I know that can be very helpful, or have music. And you can make sort of like a lanyard with a tag or a tag on the shirt or a t-shirt or something that says, you know, I have autism, or please be patient with me. I see that a lot. And I think that's really helpful because some people just don't understand. A lot of disabilities aren't obvious when you're looking at somebody.
Dr. Jones, any thoughts about this?
I would also talk to the flight crew so that they're aware of your child. I think they are often helpful and can work with families for whatever special things they need. And if they're aware, if there's a problem, they can step in and be ready to handle the situation. You know, I've said in the future, tap a person on the back and say, I'm sorry, I have this toddler. She may be kicking the seat, you know, or something like that. So talk to people around you and let them know. And I think people will come together and help make it as easy as possible.
That is Dr. Candace Jones from Orlando, Florida, and Dr. Jamie Friedman from San Diego, California. They are both board-certified pediatricians offering their advice for how to travel with kids. Thank you both so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Peter Bryant. In for Alex Crow, our producer is John Davis. And join us every weekday from 5 until 9 for Morning Edition on WPR. News coming up in a moment and then Morning Classics. Stay tuned.
You rely on Wisconsin Public Radio for independent journalism, compelling stories, and refreshing entertainment. Member support is the largest source of funding for the WPR programs you value and enjoy every day. Thank you, members. You make it all possible.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, hit Hollywood films are screened each month in the Community Center at the Matheson Memorial Library in Elkhorn. The Friday, December 1st film is Elf. Free popcorn, soda, and candy is provided by the Friends of the Library.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake.